Yeah, we're going to be more and more careful as COVID cases increase in the province. And it's good to be very cautious with this pandemic. Yeah. Well, let's begin with the preliminary liberating. That's not for those on Zoom. You don't have to. I don't think it's transmittable across the internet cables, and so on. Let's start with the four thoughts that turn the mind from samsara. Yeah.
Excellent body and mind with leisure and endowments will be difficult to attain repeatedly in the future. Right now, we will accomplish the state of the unsurpassed Mahatabhadra to meaning we can benefit others. Also, it is not certain when the hateful enemy who has present precious body, the mark of death, will arrive. I and all other beings are impermanent, the time of death being uncertain. Since there is no opportunity for happiness wherever one is born in samsara, and since a happy existence was never seen, I'll enter the path of nirvana. In order for this body with leisure and health possess me, I'll abandon the three non-virtuous poison afflictions, develop diligence in virtuous actions, and protect the vows and commitments of the three doors.
Going for refuge? Namo. Dasyanam tanyam pe sanchenam tu dine zo la me janchubar jila kundro la malakabchi grodros oso yidam lakabchi archo kundzo kundro lakabchi kani so sangye lakabchi Mo, from now until the attainment of unsurpassed awakening, I and all such sentient beings equal space
go for refuge to the Guru and source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the boundless doors of the sea. We go for refuge to the king, dispeller of all sins. We go for refuge to the Buddha, first among demons. We go for refuge to the spot, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the song of the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to our fellows, masters of activity. Namo. Now into the attainment of unsurpassed awakening, I and all sentient beings equal space go for refuge to the Guru and the source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Dhamma, the store of supreme city. We go for refuge to the Dhini, dispeller of all sins. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to song of the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to Dhammapala's masters of activity.
Generating bodhicitta.
Oh,
beings of samsara be free from suffering, be joyful, truly abide supreme happiness. Generate the supreme mind impartial towards all in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that may fully benefit the beings of six realms, we must attain to the stage of Buddha this very lifetime. Therefore, we really diligently unsurpassed the path of endlessly clear essence. May all sentient beings of samsara be free from suffering. Be joyful and truly abide supreme happiness. We generate the supreme mind impartial towards all in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of the Buddha in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in unsurpassed teaching, the path of the limitlessly clear Vajra essence.
Now the Sattva. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manavalaya Vajrasattva Tvayana Parishta Dito Meva Sutokaya Mevava Subokaya Mevava Anurakta Mevava Sarva Siddhi Mepraya Sarva Karma Tsucha Mechitam Shriyam Guruham Ahaha O Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vendram Ame Uncha Vendram Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Om Vendra Sattva Samaya Amaru Palaya Vendra Sattva Tenupa Trito Rito Mevava Sutokaya Mevava Sutokaya Mevava Anurakta Mevava Sarva Steri Mevrayas Sarva Karma Svicha Mehiti Sam Shriyam Guruham Ahaha O Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vendra Mame Nuncha Vendri Bhava Maha Samya Sattva Om Vendra Sattva Samaya Amanu Palaya Vendra Sattva Tveno Patrishta Vrita Mevava Sutta Kaya Mevava Supa Kaya Mevava Anurakta Mevava Sarva Siddhi Mevraya Sarva karma sucha mehejitam shriyam guruham Ahaha o bhagavan Sarva tathagata Vendra mame muncha vendra bhava Maha samaya sato ha
scented waters, arranged with flowers, and adorned with silver, four continents, the sun, and the sun, and the moon. By offering the visualized through the field, may all migrating beings take birth and appear around you. Om Guru Deva Dakini Ratnam Lakrati Chalaswam.
Guru Yoga. Om Ah Hum.
Ragnar, the Ragnar,
In the blue field of one's own original pure awareness, in the palace of the ceasing inner radiance, is one's own vibrant energy, the Buddha Guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow hari. Om. In the Buddha field of one's own original pure awareness, in the palace of the ceasing inner radiance, is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow hari.
Excellent. So, how are you all doing? Great. Let's see if there's any questions regarding the practices you're doing. That might be a good time to pause and just make sure that everybody's following along and doing what they're doing. Any questions you want to ask or the clarifications? Yes. Or it's stirring something down.
Stirring something down.
Could be. Yes, if there's already, not to say you have that, but if there's already dullness, which is actually a sinking of the pranas, when you walk or you move or you slow down, then you'll feel dullness. Mm-hmm. But as you slow down and you have very bright pranas, slowing down actually is extremely energizing and awakening. So it's going to take time to get the brightness in there. So it's very normal and very classic that in tranquility, especially, and that can happen in what is called Vipassana practice, is as you try to slow down, you're getting more tranquil, but actually you're getting dull. And if you're getting dull, it's not tranquility. Many people think it is, but it's not. So you can feel good, but you're dull. It's probably the biggest accusation, you know, you see in Tibetan texts and things, the biggest difficulty in meditation, is especially in insight practice or Mahamudra, is calm, but dull, not awake. So we're going for awake. But we also need tranquility. So to do that requires a balance of making sure that you don't go and stir up the pranas by being very active, but you do practices which move the pranas so the mind feels bright and the body feels bright. Okay? Yoga, Qigong, Feldenkrais, that kind of thing. Even something of increasing the breath and, you know, some of the pranayama exercises, which we don't do while we're meditating, but we may do pranayama exercises and bandhas to actually move the pranas around and then they feel like they settle. So the reason, again, why we need to do retreats is we need to actually pass through these periods and gain confidence that dullness is transitory. Unless one has a very difficult, one has a lot of dullness as a predominant quality, and then it starts to come up. Some people find that they're angry all the time, some people find that they're greedy all the time, the three roots, and some people discover after sometimes many years that their mind is actually just dull. And they really have to brighten that. So how do you do that? Through all kinds of methods and also keeping your eyes open. So when you're moving, if you're not moving and breath circulating, you'll be very dull. And the dullness has to do with the lack of in-touchment sensation, which is a very big problem today. Whether it's been a problem in the past, I can't say, but the number of people that I talk to that simply can't feel the pervasiveness of sensation in the body is quite high. And I can't say whether that's increasing or decreasing. I would think it would, but that doesn't mean it is, by more and more use of cell phones and computers and so on, and a lack of physical attachment. So in the first stage, in the first tetrad of the Buddha's very famous teaching of the four foundations of mindfulness, the third stage of four stages of the first tetrad of awareness of body is called the full body of breath. And one has to get there. Otherwise, one only feels alive in the heart, one only feels alive in the legs, one only feels alive in the hands, and so on. But one needs to get body and sensing alive. And even if it's non-dual and it's illusory, it still needs to be there to walk or run the path. All right? So I hope that helps. You can keep asking specific questions, but in a general point of view, that is the importance of these yogas. Yogas for balancing the pranas. So whenever the pranas are not balanced, they'll at some point sink. The other thing too is, I haven't been through these with you, but there's a handout that I gave you which has the five hindrances. So when we struggle with wanting to have meditative experience, or when we struggle with wanting to have things that we aren't getting, we get very tired, we get very dull. So not just tired, but one can be very dull because the internal fight, which one doesn't necessarily even notice, the internal fight of trying to get what you want, not getting it, is extremely energy draining. Okay? So what one faces when one comes to a meditation retreat is, away from all the daily hooks and all the things that invigorate us, we don't have those things that invigorate us anymore, except for maybe fantasy. Some people go into a tremendous fantasy, like a drug, to try to get out of that dullness. Yeah? So when you come into retreat, you don't have the kinds of things that you rely on to stimulate you. Therefore, the five hindrances can hit really strongly. And when you're meditating on breath or hollow body or practicing a contemplation, it's not necessarily very exciting. So you have to have this faith and confidence. You have to have the view. You have to have a commitment that you're on the right path. Sometimes people are meditating too long. And if you meditate too many minutes, you can also, squash your brightness, okay? Because you're trying too hard for experience. So in the Mahamudra tradition and Dzogchen tradition, you meditate for short periods that are very bright and alert and extend them over time. Whereas some traditions, they start you off with an hour, right? Or 45 minutes, whatever it is, and you have to come up to that. I'm not a great believer in that. Is there a good purpose in that sometimes? Yes. It creates a discipline. People have to sit through their stages and go through it. That's excellent. But when it comes to certain types of practices, shorter is better, short periods. So that might help. So when you walk, only walk for 10 minutes and make it bright. When you sit, 10 minutes. Now, the difficulty, I'm going to tell you how this, kind of a strong say, I'm going to tell you how this works, but good possibility, is that when you're gathering the pranas and building the pranic energies like a dam through attention and awareness, every time you break the dam, it spills out. So the art of building up the charge of alertness, which is also sensation, this is a stage, requires that you don't keep breaking the gathering of attentive pranas. It's very hard to describe. You know that? Like staying with something? It's like sawing wood. But all the way through the sawing wood, you get distracted and you look around and it changes the blade. It starts making a poor cut and you wonder why. To gather the pranas, you have to move very slowly, but you have to stay alert to sensation. That way, over minutes and hours, you basically build up a tank of a pranic charge. Yeah? And you can lose it very easily. Go make a cup of coffee, go to the toilet, start thinking about things, and all of a sudden it falls. So you have to stay with sensation long enough to build an activated awareness. I don't know if it's making any sense to people. It's really very physical. It's very physiological. So to stay bright means you have to stay attentive to sensation. And why contemplations are more difficult is because, and Mahamudran Dzogchen, is because now we're not staying attentive to a sensation, we're staying attentive to awareness itself. You see? And people say, what awareness? I've had people say that to me. Well, what's the meditation? What can I hang on to? What can I meditate on? Nothing at all. But awareness. That would be like saying to people right away, meditate on space. Isn't that glorious? Just meditate on space. They go, but what? I've got no thing to hang on to. So that is why you need the pranic entouchment before you go into this openness of awareness, which is the most energetic thing you can ever encounter, because it's the vitality of your mind. It's the radiance of your mind. It's the vitality, as it says here. In the Guru Yoga, in the palace of unceasing inner radiance is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru. So when you discover that inner radiance and that aliveness of awareness, then you can stay without moving for hours, and you're not meditating on a sensation at that point, you're meditating on the openness of mind, which is incredibly energetic. Okay? So a few hints. But the most important thing for you and many people is to develop, and it's going to take months and years, is to develop a full body of aliveness so that the mind feels invigorated. Okay? And as soon as you're interested, you'll notice that as soon as you're interested in something, really, the dullness goes. Isn't that true? So therefore, when you're not interested in something, the dullness seeps in because you've lost the point, you've lost the intent, you've lost the maybe the direction of what you're doing and why you're doing it. These are some without getting into absolute specifics. The longer that you can build up the sensory awareness, you will then pass a point where it'll start to flow like melted butter. Okay? But only when you come to the vividness of awareness as a direct experience, and that becomes the most interesting thing, will there be a trying to have a samadhi, because you haven't identified the natural energy of the mind. Therefore, you're relying on the energy of sensation. Is that making any sense? So as long as you rely on the energy of sensation, you're going to have these rises and falls. If you rely on the energy of awareness, there's really no rise and fall, although the body may rise and fall. Might even be sleeping, be tired. Okay. That's good. I'm glad we covered that. Although covered it in minor detail. So sinking and too active are some of the greatest impediments to meditative stability. Sinking, too active. getting it just right is an art form. And for that, you have to slow way, way, way down and move microscopically with such a live awareness. Body invigoration. Yeah. Any questions on that? This is a very important point. Yeah. Any others? So having a hollow body. Practicing metta meditation. Metta meditation must be physical. Must be physical. Loving kindness must be physical. Yes, it's mental, but if you don't actually experience it as a physical body of kindness and wanting to care for beings, it becomes a mental thing. You're trying to get some mental thing out of it, but you also want an energetic field, luminous field that engulfs people. Yes.
While doing a hollow body, I've noticed it's more difficult to open in a certain direction, and I was wondering if there's any specific ways that we can open into an area that is particularly difficult.
Very good. Yeah. So one thing to do is just spend more time and have the intention, I will open, I will become more aware of that area. So you have the intention. Use the intention. The other thing you can do is go into an open field or go into the forest and try to feel trees and things that are in that quadrant that you're not very comfortable feeling. You know, to me, one of those beautiful practices that you can do as a tranquility and then eventually as a beautiful Mahamudra Dzogchen practice, not so much for Burmese or Thai Vipassana style. I wouldn't recommend this. But when you really want to get 360 degree awareness going, is take a forest path that's 30 meters too long, 30 feet, 60 feet, a forest path with trees, like walking to the Beaver Dam cabin is excellent. I once did a 3-month retreat at the Beaver Dam cabin and used to practice walking at night with no flashlight. I go all the way from the temple back with no flashlight, or come forward with no flashlight and just feel the road, feel the leaves and feel the trees and so on as an exercise. But whether it's dark or not, not allow the trees to be fairly close to you, like these beautiful forest paths here, and walk very slowly but not too slowly with your hands at your sides. And actually try to feel, without imagining, projecting, just feel 360 degree attachment with the ground, with the trees above and around you, and actually physically try to feel like you're walking in an alive, enriching contact, without any projection, without doing a number like the trees are alive and they're supporting me, and you don't want to get into that. Just an alive entouchment where you can feel beings. You can feel supported and alive without a kind of imaginary construct. Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. It's so enlivening. And the eyes are straight ahead. Not down like this. But keep your eyes straight ahead like this and simply allow your whole body, without imagining, without trying to see lights and all that kind of thing, just let it walk alive in the forest with your eyes open. And one of the keys to having a bright mind is perhaps for quite a long time, don't meditate in dark rooms. Meditate in a lot of light. So your head is filled with light, because it goes through, goes especially through the eyes. We're not so much like pigeons, it doesn't go through a cranium very much. But low light levels can really, really make you dull. And as the light falls, as we get to the winter, many of us are going to feel very sleepy until we get adjusted to the light levels. Yeah? So the outer environment is also affecting the inner environment. cold. Cold, change of season, change of light, all these things affect the pranas on the inside. Now, that said, one of the best things some of you can do is go for a really good run, or an invigorating walk, or a cold shower, or a hot shower, or something I do sometimes, take the whole glass of water and dump it on your head while you're meditating. Yeah. So sometimes the pranas sink so much that a good invigorating walk for a half an hour, 40 minutes is the best thing that you can do. Shake it out. Go for a long walk. You know? Shake it out. Drop all the practice you're doing and just go for a long walk without being distracted. All right? The shrinking really won't happen naturally until there's a change of pranic flow. So one way you can do that, one way to do that perhaps, I'm just coming up with things, is look at little things. Look at little things and imagine you're very tiny, like a little bubble, a little grain of seed somewhere, something like that. And go look at it, get up very close, and kind of try to feel what it's like to be very, very tiny. Yeah. You almost have to get out of the way and just let it happen. Also, maybe you could try lying down. Try lying down and let it happen. Let it happen lying down. Just make the intent and say, I would like to turn into a very tiny sphere of light, or I'd like to be like a sesame seed or a poppy, and just allow it happen. It will happen. Yeah. Again, pranas. Just pranas not flowing, and you just have to wait. Yeah. Yes. Oh yeah, so the hollow body can be done at the beginning of the generation of the Adam. Or when you're in the body of the Adam, then take some time to do the hollow body practice. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So as soon as you arise as the Adam, such as Vajrasattva, doesn't matter, Chenrezig, Three Roots, Padmasattva, Guru Rinpoche, Yeshe Shogo, then in that body, grow and become small. Grow and become small. Grow and become small. It's really important. Because remember, these Yidam, the Yidam is an awakened being of vast dimensions that's literally filling vast areas with luminous light of liberation. And one way you can do that is imagine that your body, here's a couple things that will happen eventually, but you may as well have them happen now, as we're bringing it. So imagine that your body is a Buddha body, like Virochana or Guru Rinpoche, Yeshe Shogo, but it's vast in size, and it has many planets in it. Or it actually, you can, if you look and you imagine that they're all of Canada or all of Ontario, or all the city of Ontario is actually in your body, without worrying how big your body is, you will change that. So a very beautiful practice you can do is instead of trying to bless all the earth, is visualize an earth like a marble, size of a marble, big marble, or small marble, inside your heart center. So that you're like a Buddha of a body, a nirmanakaya or sambhogakaya, that's actually including countless beings in your body. And this is really getting closer to how it is, really how it's happening. Okay? So one of the reasons for hollow body, expansion of the body, is that your body is becoming your body of radiance, your body of mind field is becoming utterly huge in dimension, which is containing countless sentient beings. Okay. So you'll see references in sutras to Buddhas of such immense size that they have multiple world systems inside their body. Just like we do right now. We have whole worlds, worlds upon worlds upon worlds inside our body. This practice also allows you to travel inside your body of luminosity. You can actually go for traveling. As the channels and the chakras become purified, they become doorways to different dimensions, spheres, states of beings, and mandalas of awakeness through traveling into the chakras, inside the chakras, which open up into space, like doors. Yeah. Okay. The most important thing is, I believe, for this path of liberation is to use the sadhana, but don't get too creative in your fantasies and trying to have experiences that aren't there because you need to have an experience. You will see in the end that the resting in vivid, bright, natural awareness and getting used to that is the key, because you're not then struggling having to have meditative experience. You're absolutely okay with the mind in its natural mode of non-clinging awareness. Therefore, if something arises, excellent. And when we practice the indivisible unity of arisings and mind, then whether there's an arising or not, it's just fine. There's no problem. Okay, just a few points. Anything else about your meditative practices or Padmasattva? Yeah. Okay, we'll go to the text. Once you have an ease of natural samadhi, which means the concentration is relatively effortless, there's a stability of concentration without effort, then contemplation like this gets easier and easier and easier, which means you can pick up an idea like this and says, okay, is there a body without consciousness? And you can basically take that as a theme without thinking too much about it, and rest in that and let it come to you, so you have a confidence to do that. Yeah. Well, that brings us to number 36. Let me know if you have any questions too about these. 36. So if it is considered that without a body there is no consciousness, the position within Chittamatra and some positions within schools, you must explain what is this awareness that is the object of one's own specific knowledge? Now, we have to take some time in this. Let's start at the end. One's own specific knowledge is this reference to self-illuminating awareness of the Chittamatrans. Own specific knowledge is a translation of self-illuminating awareness, this luminous jnana. So to explain this, we have to go back to the five heaps, the five skandhas. Body, or appearance. Form. Feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Perception, volitional states, and subject-object consciousness. Can you separate one of the heaps, one of the factors of the heaps, from the others? What happens? So if you take away, if you have five, and you take away mental feeling, can you have the rest? So from the point of view of the Buddhist model, or the Buddhist construct, if you wish, of the five skandhas, the five heaps, they're a unified whole. There's five activities operating within a unified whole. So if you take away body, appearance, can you actually have consciousness? This is the question. Many people feel that if you take away a body, you can have this consciousness, right? You don't need a body. What happens after death? So here's a question: if you or anybody dies, do they require a body to be conscious? When the body dies, does consciousness pass away?
Don't they define consciousness as always being tied to an object? So if there is no object being perceived, then there is no consciousness. Isn't that what they're saying?
Mm-hmm.
So these factors, the feeling, perception, and volitional states, are they embedded in the consciousness? Do they happen sequentially, or are they in qualities of that consciousness?
So imagine a millet or a rice pot like this, and it's all bubbling. All the grains are the five skandhas, but they're bubbling. And sometimes you notice one more than the other, and therefore you feel that there's vedana, but you've now forgotten about the four others. Or there's form, but there's no longer sensation. So the question is, can you separate them out?
Well, each time you separate them, that's a new moment of consciousness, isn't it? Isn't that another object of consciousness as you separate them out?
That's right. So can you have this separate individual consciousness as an entity? That's really what they're asking.
An entity being an experience or an ongoing thing?
Well, the question is, if you experience an experience as thing-like, you now have a thing.
Although, but in absolute terms, you never have a thing. You already established that.
So what he's doing is he's trying to demolish the last things that are being posited. That's what he's doing. He's going after slight views, which are important views, where in the process of the Chittamatra model, if you wish, of experience, they're still retaining entity-like things. That's what he's going after. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
They're treating it as though it's their criticism of it is that they see it as a thing.
They say it isn't. They say it isn't, but they're treating it that way. That's what he's getting at. So can you have consciousness or awareness outside of form? And if you're saying that, then you're making consciousness kind of a continuous thing that doesn't break apart, that doesn't Yes, that's what he's saying. Yes.
What about arupa jhanas?
Well, can you have so here's the thing. Arupa jhanas, is there no body in arupa jhana? You say, well, it's formless. There's a formless experience, but there still is a mental body. This is where I, not just myself, but there's some debate about this. I would say, as long as you're in a rupa jhana, there is still form. It's a form body. It's extremely refined. You won't feel you have a body, but there's still the five skandhas. You haven't broken the five skandhas. This is where I disagree, even with the term. I know this is kind of heresy, but I don't buy it. In my own experience, I don't buy it. Yeah, arupa jhanas is that there's, people usually translate, no form, no body, no form. No, there's still a form body. Just like as there is, a sambhogakaya has a form body. Yeah. And when you dream, you have a form body, and when there's death, there's still a body. That body is a mental body. Yeah. It's just extremely refined. Extremely refined. So the body of an arupa being is vast, vast, almost indefinable body of billion of thousands of kilometers that's just so spread out. But it's not it's a very fine, super fine body. And that's where I kind of don't quite agree with the translation. Arupa, no form. No, there still is a an appearance. Yeah, there we go. Appearance. Even though there's no body, there's still an appearance. And that body is a very different kind of body. Yeah. No body. You have no body, but there's still an appearance. Yeah. And then when you come to perception, no perception, neither perception nor non-perception, you can't even find that there is a perception. But there's still is some sort of beingness there.
Otherwise, you'd never promote it.
That's great. And there'd be no recollection of it. This is extremely refined. Yeah. Yeah. Even the experience of nothingness, no thingness that can be found, doesn't mean there is not a form body, but you're not experiencing it at the time. So can you have a being, a so-called being, that has no body? In according to some traditions, yes. There's no body, but there's no body as we know the body. You might want to say there is an embodiment, but this is a very debatable point. This is a really, Theravadins wouldn't like this at all. Okay, let's, then it says on 36, you must explain what is this awareness? What is this knowledge of consciousness that is the object of one's own self-illuminating awareness? 37, by calling it a specific awareness, you'll see how this develops too as we go along. By calling it a specific awareness, self-illuminating awareness of itself, you are asserting it to be an entity, yet by stating it, it is this, or this is it, you are asserting it also to be powerless. Now, I'm not absolutely convinced that, and that this is where we'd have to open up to Tibet and so on, that powerless is found actually in the text. Other people aren't using the word powerless. In other words, is the word powerless here being imputed into the text, and any entity, as soon as you're an entity, or as soon as you see an entity, you've taken the power away from it. Why? Because it's now confined, solid, restricted, and defined, when in fact it can't be. So you've now made the self-illuminating awareness without power, because any power, anything that is an entity rises and passes away. That's what they're saying. You've now kind of done in self-illuminating awareness. Because you've made it momentary, time-dependent, and an entity. And he's saying, this is wrong. It's wrong view. Yes.
So is he getting at that this experience of the self-illuminating awareness is actually a very refined, conventional experience? But in the Buddha, there's a discourse where the Buddha talks about how things regress and it finally gets back to nirvana, and he says, that's it, you can't go any further. So this may be just like a manifestation of the radiance that ultimately will regress back to emptiness, but it's a display of you could call it conventional in a sense.
You could, but how for any of you do you describe profound experience? So by describing profound experience, godlike, Buddha-like experience, he's going to warn later, in your attempt to help other beings. Oh, next line here. Having ascertained oneself and to help others ascertain, the learned proceeds excellently, always without error. He's saying that in your description of such profound meditative absorption and trying to help other people understand it, you've now made it into an entity. Into an entity. Into a self-nature. And that's the whole point here, is that these great meditators, these profound meditators, who had amazing abilities, we're trying to help others see that there's something beyond the five skandhas. There's something beyond this emptiness of you. And by doing so, by describing it and creating a new model, they've also now created a new self. That's what he's, in the simplest terms, that's really what he's saying. So in your compassion, you've now strayed into making the self-illuminated emptiness, a self-illuminated mind, into another mind with labels. And he's saying, let's smash this apart to go further. Because his realization, Nargarjuna's realization, was even further. That's what he's saying. And he's saying it's unborn. The Buddha said it's all unborn. It's all mind. But mind is unborn, so how could you make this way? That's what. Is everybody following? So by creating a new level of experience, not creating, by discovering a new level of experience and trying to describe that and then making a model of it, you've fallen into the trap of creating entityness. And that was the criticism. Even though they said we're not doing that. And I think they weren't doing that, actually.
No, because they were addressing the process of cognition for the purpose of removing suffering. They didn't really care about the metaphysical side of it. Well, that's what...
They did, because they were trying to move the understanding of Dharma forward, but in so doing they created a model which was sticky. And Nargarjuna is saying even that has to be demolished to go further. And that's called the progressive stage of emptiness. So it's really hard to move beyond the stage you're in, because you can't see the stage you're in. And he's just kicking them in the pants. Even though, my readings anyways, they were very clear that they knew that wasn't the case. But that depends on who they were. So it could be that he was in monastic debates and so on and saying, you know, he was there. So hearing something and watching something and very carefully saying, be careful now you don't make your experience into a thing. It's not really shunyata. Okay. If you look at some of the other translations here, number 37. affirming self-cognizing consciousness, they Chittamatrans, say it is a real existent entity, and yet also say that it's impossible. He's saying you can't have it two ways, folks. You can't, at the one sense, make it the absolute consummate truth thing, attainment, and at the same time say it's not real. You can't have it both ways for it to be described as this or that. So that's what he's saying. And if you do that, you then take the power away out of it. Number 38, having ascertained oneself and to help others ascertain. Ascertain means to see, yeah, to bring certainty, yeah, to convince, to bring certainty to the Chittamatra view, which is a very high view. The learned, now they're saying the Chittamatrans, proceeds excellently, always without error. That's kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's saying, you guys are amazing, but be careful that you've proceeded maybe too fast and have there's some errors have slipped in. That's what Nagarjuna is saying. All right? It's not like saying, you've got some errors, and the learned always move very slowly and carefully to make sure there's no errors when they are there to show people what they've discovered. That's what it's saying. Number 38. Let's see if any other translations here. To convince themselves as well as others, those who are intelligent should always proceed without error. That sounds like a good, always a great recommendation for scientists. If you are going to convince others, you really need to proceed carefully and make sure that you haven't stumbled into some wrong view and errors. Actually good for all of us. It's another way of saying to the Yogacarans, please be cautious with your logic. It's a bit sloppy. Okay, 39. The cognizer, or the subject, perceives the cognizable object. Without the cognizable, there is no cognition. Therefore, why do you not admit that neither object nor subject exists at all? And he's saying that this gets into a sloppy place. The subject and the object, the cognizer and the cognizable, are interdependent, which means it's empty of any real thing. Without the cognizable, there is no cognition. It's interdependent. As a room full of practitioners who are hearing a Dharma talk or interacting with me, to get rid of you, all I need to do is this. Or as I think Louis the 16th did, he would go like this. And they're all gone. So this, in other words, if you take away the interdependence, then all of a sudden it falls like waves. If you change the weather pattern, the pond goes from having waves on it all of a sudden to being very calm. If you change the weather pattern, the lake or the ocean then has tremendous waves and surges and this sort of thing, see? It's interdependent. There's no such thing as the waves without the ocean, or the other way around. So therefore, why don't you admit that neither object nor subject exists at all? So he's basically saying, they're saying only mind truly exists, but they're also showing that a little bit of sloppiness, that cognizing awareness is the thing. And he's saying the cognizing awareness, too, must be empty. So if you have a cognizing awareness, that cognizing awareness must be empty of any real characteristics. And you're going to think, this is the end. We've entered into a place where no matter what we show to be the wisdom mind, it's not going to have any real characteristics, so it's a dead-end place. And here we reach a point, which is a great argument of some Buddhist philosophy, that says this self-illuminating awareness can't be real, it's empty. But they don't actually posit anything else. Whereas in the third turning of the Buddha's teaching, Buddha nature, teachings of Maitreya, great awakened being Maitreya, the future Buddha, the only thing that truly exists is Buddha nature, which is the nature of emptiness. And it kind of goes back the same way, but they're very careful in the way it's explained and the way it's expounded not to fall into the trap of the Chittamatrans. And that's what we're going to see. It's very beautiful. Okay, number 40. The mind is but a mere name. Apart from its name, it exists as nothing. So view consciousness as a mere name. Name, too, has no intrinsic nature. Now, you may say that in reading that, we've just come back way back in the verses to something we already know. But what he's saying in 40 is saying the Chittamatrans also fell into the trap of naming and concept making in the model they created, which was a super high model, by the way. We're talking about beings with superb meditative realization. But then they made a model for everybody to try to show this next level of realization. But he's saying you've fallen into mere labels and names again. So if you put in the text in number 40 and put in, let's say in brackets, recognize that the mind is but a mere name. And if you take the word name and you turn it into label, you might have a better feel of what this means. Okay? Sometimes we need to use a number of different translations to bring out the meaning. Recognize that the mind is but a mere label. As soon as you define mind, you've labeled it. But we need to do that for compassionate reasons to help beings, including ourselves. Okay? That's the difference in the matrix. Have a cookie. Yeah, but you're not helping me. I know, because you're unhelpable. No. But have a cookie. But sometimes we don't need a cookie. Sometimes we need relative descriptions to help us move along. But we need to know that there are fingers pointing to the moon, but they're not the moon. So, apart from its name, it exists as nothing. To get personal, you can use the exercise which I've given many times, and I think Namjoon Rinpoche used to do this one too, is just call out your name. Keep calling out your name until you hear it as you see it, as an echo of nothing but space moving through space. Your name, your name, your name, your name, your name. Or if you have an emotional connotation of the Dharma Center, Dharma Center, Dharma Center, Dharma Center. And you'll realize that everything associated with the Dharma Center are the constructs. This isn't bad or wrong, it's just correct. Everything we hold on to are constructs, labels. Labels. Phantoms. So, apart from its name, it exists as nothing one can define. So, not as nothing. I prefer not to say, not to, I've got it, it's all right. Not to say nothing. Not to say something. So don't say something. and don't say nothing. Say, no definability. It's a great way to end an argument, by the way. Great way to end a discussion. Can't go there, should go there, won't go there, and not necessary to go there. You've got all these different things that can happen and be useful. So view consciousness as a mere name. So view consciousness as a mere name. Name too has no intrinsic nature. In the same way that shunyata is not a thing. Shunyata is a name. Boy, did I get into not hot water, but angry being once responded to a poem that was put up on the internet. I think it's still up there. I don't know. On the website. And I got a letter from, I know, a very good Buddhist scholar, famous Buddhist scholar, and he was pissed off. He said, because in the poem I say, shunyata is still, in the end, don't be confused, shunyata is a name, is a label. And he goes, shunyata is not a label, it's reality. It's interesting, eh? I never even studied this stuff. But anyway, so shunyata is a label. As soon as you the word shunyata is real, you've made it a label. And he was mad at that. So I wrote back in an email. I said, why are you so mad? Why are you getting so mad about a label? If I say shunyata doesn't truly exist, now why are you so angry? And that was never heard back. Then you'll say, then why would you ever use the word shunyata? As a finger pointing to the moon. So if you're hearing Dharma, sometimes it's very important to listen to the words, because the words and the concepts help point you in the right direction. Sometimes when you're with a teacher, less hearing the words and hear the feel of the teacher's mind pointing out what it actually is. If you have a genuine teacher who has some genuine experience, they may be residing in that experience. You want to also interdependently reside in that experience. There's a time for writing and there's a time for not writing. There's a time for shutting up and there's a time for being active. Right? Because there's no separation. If you realize this, Guru Yoga, there's no separation between the mind of the practitioner and the mind of the teacher. See? This is why we practice Guru Yoga. It's the fast, as Antrim Perche said, as said a number of times, it is the fastest path. In the palace of unceasing inner radiance is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru. You discover the root guru as the inseparable nature of appearance emptiness. Not as somebody else. So that's why it's called the fast path, because you discover that your mind's nature is in fact the guru's mind's nature. 41. Either within or likewise without, or somewhere in between the two, the conquerors, the Buddhas, have never found the mind. So the mind has the nature of an illusion. Ah, beautiful. You can't find the mind, but the mind appears illusory-like. Isn't that cool? He's being very succinct. And this is at the heart of Vajrayana practice. This is what we practice when we practice sadhana. Vividly appearing, but nothing really there. The yidam body appears, but you can't truly find it. So anybody saying, but I can't visualize the chen, I can't visualize Padmasattva as me. That's because you're clinging to a real body. You want to have a body like you know a body. No, you want to have a body like Yidam that is millions of kilometers across and you can't even truly find its limits or its definition. How's that for a body? See? So holding on to solidity means that you're going to be frustrated that the body of illusion that's arising, the body of conjuring that's arising, the Yidam, is not like your body experience. That is correct. That's why it's highly transforming. So if you go meditate and you find that you have no mind, you can't find mind as such, congratulations. That's not a very comfortable position for many people. They're in the Dharma to find their mind. Many people come to the Dharma or any spiritual tradition to find themselves, isn't that right? To find themselves. What happens if you can't find yourself? What would happen if that is completely a false premise, to find yourself? When there's no real self to be found, but there is a self-illuminating awareness that's the nature of shunyata. So for some people, that's not a very comfortable position. Therefore, for some people who are meditating, it bloody well freaks them out, should I be blunt. You have to develop a maturity in your own skin to be able to tackle on something that has indefinable qualities. Could you imagine people coming to a public Dharma class and saying, and you say, you're not going to find anything. Well, what are we doing? You're not going to find yourself, but in the end, you're not going to find a thing called Buddha nature. Huh? You have to have a real maturity to go, this is just, I'm going to discover unobstructed freedom. Wow. You can't obtain Buddhahood because it's already awake. There's nothing to obtain. Awakeness is already the nature. But of course, you can attain to Buddhahood. What do you attain to? That which is already as it is, with no definable characteristics. But would you teach out of compassion that the conquerors have never found the mind? No, at a certain place, out of compassion, the conquerors have no and can describe Buddha nature, correct? They can teach that. Make sense? Out of compassion to lead beings, because most beings aren't going to want to be told you're not going to find anything in the end. But you will be different. By not finding anything in the end, you will be different. Could you imagine teaching to first-year undergraduate science students that science has no fact? You're never going to find a fact in your life in science? What? No, no facts. Just probabilities. What? What am I doing here? Yeah. So you have to have a certain maturity to be able to rest in no fact, but relatively factual. 42, the distinctions of colors and shapes, or that of object and subject, of male, female, and the neuter, the mind has no such fixed forms. These are the dimension of the relative labels and constructs. Is there anybody, how many people in the room, you could show a show of hands, how many people in the room would say that you're female? So obviously female. Okay, and how many in the room would say you're obviously male? And how about some other designated label? Transgender? Neither? Anybody? No? Yes? Okay. But we know actually in biology that no one has ever found a pure female. And no one's ever found a pure male. As a matter of fact, more and more, with genetic analysis, I'm not sure I'd say that, genetic mapping, and the looking at cells within a human being or other creatures, we begin to see that this idea of a sex, a definable sex with definable features, is becoming less and less tenable. There is, like everything else in life, a spectrum of male, a spectrum of female. You know? Right now, all the females in this room have male, truly male cells moving around within them. Some of you may not know this, but some of you females or males may actually have female organs in some form that are actually there, but never know it until you have an operation. Or you go to the hospital and they have to do genetic testing, and they come back and say, Mr. So-and-so is a miss. We have to call you miss. Your genetics show us clearly that you're female. Or Mr. So-and-so. Your bowel issues are to do with the fact that you have a uterus. What? Yeah, never knew. Yeah, you have a uterus. We have some complications because there's some bowel issues, but actually it's to do with your uterus. Or same thing with females. So you don't. We don't know this because we actually don't examine people this way. Yeah, but what we do is we examine people and we say they're female because they exhibit something to do with their physical features. You know, it's very easy. We did this at Dharma Center in a 5-month retreat here years ago. Were anybody there? We changed clothing, and people walked around and went, "Oh my God!" All of a sudden, they're female. You know, it's not so hard to change with behavior from a male to a female or a female to a male. So what constitutes these things? Yeah. So mind. So this is how you practice. So some of you are going to say, so tell me how to practice. Like this. Sit, stand, do whatever you want. And actually look into the awareness, not the object, not even the thing that's perceiving, just the field of awareness, and see in the field of awareness if you can find these labels. Where in awareness are these labels? And when we say awareness, go into the field or the feel of experience. The experience as such, loosely open experience, and see that if we're looking at a door, whether there's actually a label called door. Can you find any labels or defining characteristics? So mind has no such fixed appearances. This is important. 43. In brief, the Buddhas have never seen, nor will they ever see such a mind as a fixated thing, as a defined characteristic. So how can they see it as intrinsic nature, swabhava, or as a thing? When we say we're looking for the innate or intrinsic nature of ourselves, that which is devoid of intrinsic nature. So how can we find intrinsic nature to that which is devoid of an intrinsic nature? And this point 43 is very difficult for a dualistic mind to handle, because we still want to find something. Isn't that amazing? And why do we want to find something? Because we're not comfortable resting in non-clinging awareness. We're not comfortable resting in the mind in the way it actually is. We want to rest in the mind with characteristics. If I say to all of you, some of you can do this because you're well practiced, but some of you, if I say to you, now just look at awareness for an hour. I've had this happen. It's great. Mahamudra retreats, weekend Mahamudra retreats, things. Just look at your awareness for an hour.
I had no idea what to do.
That was great when that happened.
I had no idea what to meditate on.
What do I meditate on? You see? So the need for an identifiable experience and identifiable characteristics is so deep and so clinging that we even need to remove that. Okay. And you'll say, but then there's nothing. No, not nothing. Not something, not nothing. It's called non-conceptual, non-clinging, illuminating awareness. 44. I might get to 50 today. 44. Entity is a conceptualization. Absence of conceptualization is emptiness. Where conceptualization occurs, how can there be emptiness? Easy, actually. But on this one, number 44, I would prefer Lintner's translation. It's excellent. A thing is a construct. Shunyata is absence of constructs. This tells you exactly how to practice Mahamudra Dzogchen. 44. So if you want to write this down, it's beautiful. It's like a pith instruction for practice. It's just a different translation. A thing is a construct. Shunyata is absence of constructs. A thing is a construct. Shunyata is absence of constructs. Where constructs have appeared, how can there be shunyata? Okay. So how would you do this? Sitting like this, or like that, or some way. Keep letting all the constructs vanish into their own nature. Okay. In other words, you've got to be brave. You got to stay to it. You're staying with awareness. And wherever a construct arises, one has to see it as a construct and let it dissolve of its own accord because it never was a real thing. So that means step by step by step, letting constructs collapse. What are some of the biggest constructs that are going to have to collapse? And by the way, collapse doesn't mean like the whole building falling apart. Oh, that will happen. But like going into space, like a cloud vanishing into space. What's a big one? Body. Feelings as being real, volitional states, the perception is real. He's knocking all these things back, all down. That duality is real, that there must be something cognizing and something, and there must be an experience. These are so deep, you have to soften them. Dharma is a bit like Feldenkrais. A bit like Feldenkrais. Don't go at the core, go at the edges. If you go to the core issue right away, which is non-duality, you can frighten people off. If you say there's no mind to find, there's not even a Buddha to find. There is no attainment of bodhisattvas. You're going to scare everybody away. They're not even going to practice the path. Yeah? So what do? Out of compassion, you nibble at the edges. Right? You have these beautiful provisional teachings, which are glorious, by the way, absolutely glorious. Loving kindness, compassion, right? Sympathetic joy, equanimity, fantastic. So you nibble away at the edges until a mind can actually experience and rest in a non-constructed, non-conceptual view. So, beautiful, beautiful, number 44, direct instruction. The absence of constructs. Don't force it. Identify them, feel them, and let them, just like clouds, vanish into space. Just like clouds. Why? Because they are clouds appearing from space. That's all. That's it. Like Denise appearing in this room today is like a cloud appearing, and one day it won't. But if you cling to it, or any of you, you cling to it, then you created a location of space. So the art is to let go of the clinging. How do you do that? Not by fighting it, not by beating it, not by making it disappear, but by seeing it. That's called penetrative insight, seeing its empty nature. Creating nothingness is clinging. Creating somethingness is clinging. Experiencing its nature, which has no characteristics, is the right way. The mind in terms of the perceived and perceiver. This the Tathagatas have never seen. Where there is the perceived and perceiver, there is no enlightenment. As long as one is taking up a dualistic position as being real, that doesn't mean you can't have dualism. Right? Doesn't mean you can't have dualism. Doesn't mean you can't have a watch and a person. But as long as if you feel that's real, then there's no enlightenment. But if you know it's illusory like a dreamlike construct of the nature of mind, then you're fine. It's fine. It's like one person went to Ante Rinpoche and said, I'm having a real difficulty with my thoughts. That's what they told me. I said, go see Ante Rinpoche. But someone said, I'm really having difficult. Someone, what's the problem with your thoughts? Why are you considering thoughts a problem? Well, isn't that the problem? No. It's if you know you have thoughts, that's fine. Not a problem. But if you don't know you have thoughts, then you're now clinging to having to have no thoughts, then you've got a problem. So having no thoughts is clinging to no thoughts. Can a thought hurt you? How about this? Can any thought hurt, create damage? Yes, if you believe it can create damage. Imagine if you grow up and you believe that thoughts create damage, that you can be harmed by thoughts. Then you will have thoughts creating damage. But imagine if you actually know that no thoughts can actually create damage in any way, shape, or form. Because you've contemplated it so deeply. So, if you change the word perceived to known and perceiver to knower, I think that helps. The mind in terms of the known and the known and the knower, this the Tathagata has never seen. Where there is the known and knower, there is no enlightenment. So I would like you to try this again. I've already pointed this out many times, but try this. Try to see if in pure experience that there's anything at all that is separate from the experience. Just look around the room very slowly, beautifully, and look around, see, is there anything other than the experience? Is there anything out there in experience other than the knower and knower as the same nature? Can cognition ever be separate from the objects it's cognizing? Is that something? See, you've got masks on, so you can't say hallelujah. But just look. You'll see. Just like the Amazon River merging with the Rio Negro, they're inseparable. Just like space merging with space, they're absolutely inseparable. You can never have an experience without the experience actually being the nature of mind. It's not possible. Simply not possible. Isn't this straightforward? Can you just dwell on that? Okay, you got it. Go out and do that all day long until one day it happens, and it's literally, as they say in the text, the sadhanas, like water merging into water. That the experience of the object is indistinguishable of the mind. The object is emptiness, and the mind is emptiness. There's no such thing as an object, and there's no such thing as a mind. Okay. When you have that experience, and you can now mature that experience through weeks and weeks of meditative practice, then you can abide in that experience very naturally. Can abide in that, and that becomes the natural samadhi of emptiness and appearance. Forty-six, devoid of characteristics and origination. In other words, I'll read it first. Devoid of characteristics and origination, devoid of substantive reality and transcending speech, space, awakening mind, and enlightenment possess characteristics of non-duality. Oh, beautiful. Many ways to translate this, but absence of characteristics, defining characteristics, large, small, big. This is why I'd like you eventually to have the experience of simultaneously vast and simultaneously tiny. I hope some of you had that. It's a pretty lovely experience. Giant, 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 huge, tiny, 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 exactly at the same time. This is a very beautiful experience where the experience of this simultaneously now smashes away the idea of big and small, even position. Devoid of characteristics and origination. That origination means birth. When were you born? When was the experience born? Devoid of a substantive reality and transcending speech. Space. Then we have bodhicitta and enlightenment. Bodhicitta and bodhi possess the characteristics of non-duality. Beautiful. There's some other translations here. Lintner's translation, space, bodhicitta, and enlightenment are without marks, without generation, without an arising. They have no structure. They are beyond the path of words. See, it's very different. They're beyond the path of words. At some point, It's beyond words. Just is beyond words. We use words to get there, but at some point we have to abandon all words. At some point you got to put away the Dharma books. At some point you're going to have to put away everything you ever knew and let your mind unbind and not be scared to do that. Really. Every last holding, even the pith instructions. Just everything has to unbind. They're not right, they're not wrong, but even the idea of meditation, even the idea of I'm meditating, there's an object of meditation, I'm going to achieve Buddhahood. At some point, all these things have to fall. Yeah, I like that translation. It's really... Space, bodhicitta, and bodhi, enlightenment, are without marks, without generation, without origination. They have no structure. They are beyond the path of words. Their mark, their characteristic, is non-duality. That is so beautifully put that you could take that as a meditation and just stay with that. Day after day after day, that's what you meditate on. Just let your mind unbind. Space, the wish to liberate all sentient beings, and bodhi, awakeness, those three characteristics. So then you're saying, well, what do I meditate on? Spacious awareness, like being lifted into all of space, like sky is vast, the wish that every single being becomes liberated, and complete awakeness, enlightenment, are without marks, without any characteristics, no position, no place, not big, not small, not vast. There's no origin, there's no place where it arises. They have no structure. There's no internal structure you're going to find. Ah, this is the structure of the awakened mind. They are beyond the path of words. No more words. The mind has shut up. Their mark is non-duality. The experience is non-dual. 47. Those abiding in the heart of enlightenment, the Ningpo, Ningpo Bodhicitta, which is that beautiful Bodhicitta prayer we do every day at the beginning of classes. Such as the Buddhas, the great beings, the Mahabodhisattvas, and the great compassionate ones, always understand emptiness to be like space, space-like, not space, space-like. So how do you do that? Get up on a hill, get out of the forest, get up, look up, and let your mind kind of merge with the sky. Not some fancy experience, so that when you're like this, and you're like this, and you're walking in the forest, it's the same mind. How do we discover that mind? Sometimes the best way is, as it says in the Dzogchen text, Mahamudra, don't be in a forest, get way up on a hill on a mountainside, and look. Your meditation is elevated like space, like the great sky. And then you can come down, and then you can bring it anywhere. You go, space-like, words are space-like, forms are space-like, all is space-like. Not space, not empty, space-like. 48, therefore, constantly meditate on this emptiness, on this space-like characteristic, not spaced out, not vague, not spacey, absolutely, remember, so look at those words above. Space, awakened mind, and enlightenment. Spacious, yet awake, vivid. Spacious, but holding every single being in your heart without contrivance to be awakened. Great love. Therefore, Bodhisattvas, 48, you can add in Bodhisattvas, it's implied, therefore Bodhisattvas constantly meditate on this emptiness, the basis of all phenomena, tranquil and illusion-like together, groundless and destroyer of cyclic existence, destroyer of samsara. Groundless. There's no ground that any of us are standing on. There's no ground for the mind. There's no basis for this experience. You just discover that. And yet it's illusion-like. Everything manifests out of this. Isn't that amazing? All the beings in this room are manifesting out of this Bodhi. Just appearing like bubbles in space. Isn't that amazing? Just bubbles. Bubbles popping in space. And it destroys cyclic existence because there's no clinging. There's no holding on. There's no production of more karmic formations. I'm going to go to 50. Just a challenge. We could stop anywhere. 49, as non-origination and as emptiness, or as no self grasping at emptiness as such, he who meditates on a lesser truth, on a lesser path of liberation, that is not true meditation. So there he said exactly what meditation is. I hope that's not too disconcerting for some of you. When he says meditation, he means something different. He means these qualities. Non-origination is no birth. Nothing arises. And all is shunyata. And you will not find, when you truly meditate, a grasping at self or at emptiness. He who meditates on a lesser truth, which is, for instance, no self, there's a real no self. He who meditates on constructed reality or fantasy or like a guided type of meditation which makes a construct, person who meditates on loving kindness, on even compassion, that's not true meditation. However, it is meditation and it can be very compassionate. And it's not lowly and it's not wrong, but it's not, from the point of view of bodhisattvas and buddhas, what is real meditation, or gom, called in Tibetan, gom. What's the true meditation? This. No grasping at all. No origination, just abiding in the unborn nature. 50. Anybody want to ask any questions about that? Any confusion, any consternation, yes?
Other forms of meditation, such as concentration or something like that, those are like stepping stones for the purpose of getting the ultimate.
Exactly. Very good. They're training. So most of what is called meditation is playing scales. We play scales until we can launch into a full natural symphony. In other words, we launch until we can hear the music of ah or hung or the pervasive nature of awakeness without trying to meditate. Does that make sense? Yeah. So we play scales. You do, but you also have to try with loving kindness and evenness and not work yourself up into a contorted pretzel. Yeah? If you're a pretzel, you're bound so tightly with all these views and things that you have to do, and I have to meditate so hard that you can be over pushy. If you're too lazy and too lax, then you don't go anywhere either. So you have to have a heart a bodhi, you have to have a heart of liberation. This very encompassing, but also very relaxed and not pushy, edgy, weird. Yeah? Pushy, edgy, weird practitioners are pushy, weird practitioners. And boy, it's obnoxious. It's extremely obnoxious. Yeah. It's like, you know. And you can tell something's not right. So that's why the word true is in there. That is not meditation. No. Not true. And actually the word true there would be ultimate meditation. Let's not say true or wrong or anything like that. All kinds of people are practicing really excellent meditation, but they don't necessarily know what the meditation is. So when we come to Dzogchen and Mahamudra, at some point the Lama introduces you directly by being in the room. They introduce you to meditation. Meditation which is freedom, not meditation which is contrived. That's called the view. That's okay. So don't beat yourself up. Consider the meditations that you do as wonderful trainings to someday discover non-meditation. The last stage of Mahamudra is non-meditation. No more meditation to do. It's effortless. Why? Because it's the mind. Meditation in that sense is mind. There's nothing to meditate on other than mind. It's kind of making sense, eh? I hope it is. If you understand it logically, it's quite correct. Logically, you know. It is absolutely correct. There's nothing you could meditate other than mind. And what's mind? Experience. There isn't anything else. And I'm not saying meditate on meditative experiences, just experience. And then you can relax. You can really relax. Because you're not going after anything except bodhi, which is more awakeness, greater freedom, greater compassion for beings, and space-like vast mind. So this is it. 50. Oh, we're going to get there today. Which is a concept, but a delightful concept. 50. The notions of virtue and non-virtue, characterized by being momentary and disintegrated, or momentary and falling away. The Buddha has spoken of their emptiness. Other than this, no emptiness is held. So, dangerous point. Dangerous point of Dharma. One has to go beyond virtue and non-virtue, beyond ethics and non-ethics, beyond am I doing it right? Is this the right thing? You have to go beyond that. But at the same time, if you go beyond it too quickly, or you read a Dzogchen text or a Mahamudra text and you skip ahead, right, as we all do, could open any one in there, skip ahead and no more posture. Oh, cool. Meditate like this. It's relaxing, isn't it? A nice armchair, maybe a lazy boy. In other words, you go to Fenland Falls, you buy a lazy boy, you know, with the big containers for root beer and coffee and your beer, and you sit back and you go, it says no more posture, no more contrivance, no more meditation. So great. It's kind of relaxing. But it's too early. It's way, way too early in instruction. So you really generally have to wait until your teacher, your meditation teacher says, that give it all up. Give it up. Yeah, but what posture? Give it up. What do I say? Give it up. What contemplation? Give it up. What meditation? Give it up. Oh yeah, so I practice. No, give it up. And then if you're ready, you give it up. You know what it means to give it up. But it doesn't mean you're not sitting like this. You may very well be sitting like this. But you're giving it up. When you discover that this and this, and walking, and speaking, and talking, and having thoughts is the same mind's nature, then we discover no more meditation. Same. Nothing's changed. Nothing's come, nothing's gone. Same nature. But if you start playing around too early and you give up ethics, bad news. Really bad news. Or virtue. Okay? There may be ultimately no virtue. You know there's no karma. You all know that, right? There's no karma. But there is for conceptual minds. So what a terrible thing to do, to disregard karma in a conceptual world. Even if you knew there was no karma being produced. There's not any beings having meditative experiences. There's not actually any beings attaining Buddhahood. And yet, they do. It's quite magical. The Buddha has spoken of their emptiness. Other than this, no emptiness is held. You got to go beyond, beyond, beyond. Let's see how some other translations. Here's another translation. Notions about positive and negative have the mark of disintegration. They're not, they can't be established to be real. The Buddhas have spoken of them in terms of shunyata, but the others do not accept shunyata. In other words, others are still playing with concepts. Emptiness, the Buddhas have defined as but the ending of the stream of good and evil thoughts. They do not speak of emptiness in any other way. Interesting. So if you're sitting and contemplating emptiness, the empty nature, and you're going, this is good, then what have you detected? So you're sitting there going, this is really good. This is very virtuous. What have you strayed into? Pardon? Conceptual contrivance. And that's what I call the BS detector of Mahamudra or Dzogchen. Is you need a good BS detector like a Geiger counter that when you start to come up to conceptual contrivance, it starts to make alarm bells go off. It's really in the case. You just sit there. I mean, all you have to do is just sit like this and literally identify without speaking, without stories, pick up the whiff of a concept. Even like, this is good. The alarm bells should go off. Getting closer to Buddhahood. High-level bodhisattva practice. Practicing Dzogchen. Hoping for a good result. And literally, you need the great bullshit detector that just picks up every contrivance and lets them dissolve like clouds or waves into the ocean, because that's what they are. And letting the mind unbind, 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 and looking like this. Vivid. Not dull. But vivid. Alert. Aware. Vastly compassionate. And yet utterly relaxed. And totally natural. So there's another one for you. Just keep saying that. Reference. Is this natural or is it contrived? Natural or contrived? Natural or contrived? And be patient, but determined. All right, there we go, up to 50. Pretty much halfway through the text. So last time, if you hear from some people and say, oh, you know, the Bodhicitta Vivarana, nice philosophical Buddhist text. No such thing. It's full, laden with pith instructions of a very awakened mind called Nargarjuna, whoever he was. What an amazing being. Leading step by step by step to an awakeness. So, according to my watch, we have 3.5 minutes before the conceptual end of a conceptual class in a conceptual place and a conceptual time. So let's just take 2.5 minutes in a vividly relaxed posture, elevating the eyes a little bit, looking at no object in particular, letting the mind just rest in a live awareness. Bring up the feeling that all beings will be liberated. This is for all sentient beings. And then let that drop. Let the mind soar like it's in vast space. And utterly awake. Don't make the slightest effort. Nothing contrived, utterly natural. Idante punikamang asawakiwang mo tu idante punikamang asawakiwang mo tu idante punikamang asawakiwang mo tu. By this powerful activity, may it lead to the cessation of suffering states for all sentient beings. Sabe satasa gudhantu, may all beings have excellent happiness and excellent health. May all beings discover primordial awakeness. Unborn, continuous, undying, as the unity of compassion, emptiness, as the most glorious gift for all sentient beings. Sarvamangalam, 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 many blessings, many blessings, many blessings. Bye, Zoomers.
Bye.
See you tomorrow.
Nice.
Zoomers. You have a magazine, right? Magazine called Zoomers.
Magazine
called Zoomers. Or Dharma's, oh, a new one called Dharma Zoomers. Dharma Zoomer magazine.
Yeah, we should publish our own.
Dharma
Zoomers.
Chris, meet up at the cabin. That'd be great. Journal, Dharma Zoomers. You know, if this pandemic continues, that's pretty much the way it's going to be, isn't it?
He's having a great kid.
Yeah.
So, it's the Dharma Zoomer.
Yeah, yeah.
He is. I thought he was joking about when I was 60.
Parent beings, parent lama, parent teaching.
Yes,
perfectly.
Great. Wonderful.